From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Pete Stoughton.
First this morning, we have the honor of speaking with longtime local Parkite adventurer and cancer survivor Jim Doylny, who has written a memoir called Riding the Scalpel. He's joined by his co-author, Rick Barrow. He tells the story about his adventures fighting prostate cancer and living a full life all over the globe. He hosts a book signing and reception at the Corner Store at Park City Mountain this evening from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m.
And then journalist and author Jude Stewart, who has written in Revelations in Error, a guidebook to smell, joins us on air. Our sense of smell overlaps with taste, yet it is larger in perception. Smell can collapse space and time, unlocking memories and transporting us to worlds both new and familiar. Yet, as clearly as each of us can recognize different smells, the bright tang of citrus, freshly sharpened pencils, parched earth after rain, few of us understand how and why we smell.
I can't wait for that conversation. I love to talk about smell. It is so, I mean, nothing takes me to memories more quickly than smell.
It does. And it brings us right into those moments. I'm looking forward to that conversation.
Our next guest, Jim Doylny, has a very well-known name about town. Not only has he lived in Park City for longer than many of us have been alive, he's played an active role in the community as philanthropist, public servant, developer, and as adventurer. He was diagnosed with prostate cancer over two decades ago. He joins us now to talk about his unconventional approach to cancer treatment and how it weaves the story of adventure in his life. There's no shortage of adventure in Jim Doylny's life. He's joined by his co-author, Rick Barrow. The book is called Riding the Scalpel. There will be a book signing and open house reception this evening at the Corner Store from 4:30 to 6:30. Jim and Rick, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Jim, it's really hard sometimes to know where to start the story of your story. But let's go to that time that you were in Chile and you were on one of your adventures, and it was the middle of the night, and it was maybe the first time that you got this physical feeling that something was wrong. What was the adventure, first off, and then tell us about the story?
Well, we, Max, my son, and Jake Doylny decided to bike the, I think it's called the anyway, it's a dirt road that goes down through Patagonia, and we were coming from Tulupe to Cuma, I think. I can't remember. I have to reread in the book. Anyway, I realized that I didn't have the right tubes. So, you know, I'm more of a Walter Mitty than a Harrison Ford, you know. I mean, I do a lot of things that are stupid, and I had patches that I bought down there to go on our tubes, and only later did I find out why they kept going flat, because in South America, the rubber patches go on rubber tubes, and in America, synthetic patches go on, anyway, it was one of many examples, and after you get about 50 flat tires, you're going, wait, how did this happen? Anyway.
It's those kind of experiences provide the best stories, you know, the perfect bad day.
Exactly.
You never tell stories about the good days, right?
Well, I sometimes exaggerate, but yeah.
And so it was in, you kind of start off the book with, in the middle of the night, you got up, and this was perhaps the first physical manifestation of your, what would be, prostate cancer, and you were only 50, and you said, wait a minute, I'm too young for this.
Yeah, it's, well, one of the prime indicators is having to urinate more frequently, and after a while, you start questioning that. It took me about a year till I was smart enough to actually go see somebody about it.
So for you, you're in the middle of the jungle, is that correct?
Well, I've been in the middle of a lot of jungles.
Jungles, okay.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that, Pete. That's bad.
No, that's great. Give it back to us. So you're in the middle of an adventure, and you all of a sudden start realizing, hey, something might be going on. And You know, for a lot of us as athletes, you know, whether we're here in Park City or anywhere, we kind of put things to the side. It's isolated. It's probably nothing. I can push through it. For many of us, we don't really notice it until it's really traumatic or it's really monumental. Was it monumental, or was it something you were so attuned to your body that you were recognizing those clues?
Well, I once ran, I've run a lot of marathons, but I was in St. George, and the goal had been to break 3 hours. And I had to stop to urinate, and I was 71 seconds too slow. That and a headwind held me back. So at that point, I went immediately to see the doctor. It was that serious enough, because it was starting to really affect my life.
Right. 71 seconds slower. For most people, we would be happy with, you know, 71 seconds over 3 hours.
And or over 4 hours.
What for you, then, it started this progress of working through prostate cancer. And how does one, as an athlete, did you attack it, you know, I'm going to fight this whole thing? Or what was your journey?
Well, it was kind of funny. The next morning, I saw Tech Kilgore. He's a PA in town, and he's a marathoner. And he basically, actually, it was the morning before. He said, just go. I know you're showing some symptoms. Just go down there. And so I basically got referred to Winnie, another local doctor. And then Winnie said, well, you got to go down and see this guy at University of Utah. And so I called up, and they said they didn't have any appointments. So I said, well, I'll be there anyway. And they fit me in. And the next morning, I went on a long bike ride into Mexico, because that was what I'd been planning. And I didn't really want to stop doing how I was living.
You talk about there were like four different things that you could do to sort of take your cancer on, you know, head on. And you chose the fifth, which didn't exist at that time, but it was your way of doing it. So the first four are, you know, wait and see, chemo, radiation, and then having your prostate removed. And you said, nope, that none of those are going to work for me. What was the fifth method?
Fifth choice. At that time, hormone therapy was being criticized by all the doctors in the world as not the right approach. But Dr. Bob, I call him, whom the book is dedicated, along with my final ex-wife, Michelle, he basically decided to approach it differently. And he had all kinds of different approaches to medicine. I give you one that some of us will remember, but they're thalidomide. It blocked blood vessel formation. He's the first doctor in the United States to use it to control cancer. It's very common now to be used anti-angiogenesis drugs. So anyway, I'm not sure if I answered the question, but...
You did. And thalidomide, again, and you and I have talked about this before, but it was given to women who were... It started off to be some byproduct of...
It was a sedative pregnant women took to sleep better. And it blocked new blood vessel formation, which meant these thalidomide babies were born without hands and legs and things. Other than that, it wasn't a bad deal.
But for cancer.
Cancer, it's exactly what you want to do, because no part of your body can get bigger unless there's an increase in the flow of blood and blood flowing away. So one of the things you really do quite a bit is measure the vascularity around your prostate so you can know whether there's a blood flow in and out of a tumor. And that's an important indicator.
Is that the PSA score?
No, there's many ways to stage cancer, but at the back of the book, if anybody is listening, has something I call Jim's PSA 101s, because there are many, many things that are very common knowledge for people who've kept up to speed. And if you're with a doctor who disagrees with any of those statements, you probably want to find another doctor. And these statements have been validated by many very informed doctors, and one of the endorsers of the book, a University of Chicago biologist. So I really am confident in those. But anyway, prostate cancer is very confusing.
Well, Rick, you are also joining us in studio, and we're thankful to have you here. You helped write this book and brought the story to life. You knew Jim before the book, is that correct?
Yes, we were cooks at a beach town when we were in college. And then we sort of lost touch, then we reconnected, and then we did that for the next 50 years on and off. And this last time, Jim said to me, I'm writing a book. I want you to see it. And I write for a living. I said, okay, let me see that. And I went, OMG, this needs some work. So I said I would be the manager of the process. And finally, one day I said, look, let me suggest how you ought to do this. So I took one of his trips, which was one in Australia, and I wrote it. And he said, well, I like this. Why don't you do another one? I became the co-author. And this came from a box of journals, photographs, and things that Jim collected. And the cool part of this was that we had to reconstruct all 20 of these trips, and we used Google Earth to do that. Mm. So we could literally walk in the footsteps of where Jim had been and see the mountains he had seen. And that was a real fun way to do this book. And I say, I never got lost in a fjord in Patagonia. I never got lost in the desert. I never waded through crocodile creeks, but I have now because I had to write about them in the book.
Well, and I can imagine as you're going through the Google Earth, you're like, Jim, why didn't you just make this right turn over here? I can't believe you missed that.
Well, it was more like, Jim, there's no river there.
You know, I really don't like to know what's around the corner ahead of time. Sometimes I would stop when I'm on a bike tour right before the place I should have stayed. Wait. And then the next morning I'd bike by. It was always, yeah, but I met some interesting people in those places nobody else goes to.
There's a continuing theme in the book where Jim's travel method is no research, no plan. And then we'd come across and we'd be writing, first surprise of no plan. First surprise of no research. And there's a lot of that.
Not strongly recommended for those who don't have the acuity or knowledge to adapt in those environments.
Well, the fun part of it was is that, and it's the theme of the book, is that Jim is an off-path traveler. He goes to places nobody goes, and he hangs out with people nobody knows, and that's his style. Well, refusing to follow the accepted path became his path for prostate cancer, and so one reflects the other, really. And that's kind of the genius of what he did.
Mm. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Rick Barrow, who has co-authored a book with local longtime park guide Jim Doylney. It's called Riding the Scalpel. It's about Jim's adventures in life and fighting prostate cancer. There's a reception this evening at the Corner Store, the bar at Park City Mountain that Jim started and his son Max now is in charge of. It's the reception's from 4:30 to 6:30, and as Jim says, there will be food and drink provided we know our friends in Park City or something like that.
There will be some imbibing.
So it'll be a good time. You know, the way that you traveled, the no plan and no research, I used to travel that way, and I'm finding that increasingly it works less and less because of this, you know, how everyone books online for, you know, months in advance of where they're going. I don't know where I'm going 2 weeks from now, so how can I possibly book the hotel or whatever? Do you find that?
Take a tent with you and then look for a ditch.
Oh, that's my problem. Jim, you searched far and wide, you know, going back to your treatment for cancer and how it mirrored the way that you travel. Well, indeed, you did do a lot of research to tackle your prostate cancer to the degree that you just didn't. It's not that you didn't trust the doctors that you interviewed, but you felt like there must be something more. How did your intuition and or, you know, background information lead you to that?
Well, I started noticing that everybody I went to was recommending something different, and it was always the thing that they did. So I started realizing that doctors, you know, they're in business. They're not going to send you away. And so that really kicked me over the edge to where I continued to look. And truth be told, I actually saw 19 doctors. They see you for free when they're trying to recruit you, by the way. So it wasn't very hard. All you had to do was ask. 19th doctor was the guy who hated number 18 the most. And I just wanted to interview who it was. And I realized he was jealous. So anyway.
So you chose Dr. 18.
Dr. Bob.
And that's
You gotta like a doctor who says, just call me Dr. Bob.
Yeah. No kidding.
And so for you, what drew you to Dr. Bob? You know, that was it just that someone else didn't like him that much? Or what was it that drew you?
I had been through about 15 doctors, and I finally gave up and was going to submit to what's called brachytherapy, which is a very common treatment for prostate cancer. I'm in there with the nurse, and the nurse says, I said, well, I'll do anything. I'll eat grass, whatever I have to do. She says, well, it'd be better if you ate really lousy food so you'd be in worse health, and that way it'd be easier to defeat the cancer. I'm going, what? And she said, look, you probably need to talk to somebody. So somebody who had already had himself, well, I don't want to say maimed, but injured by surgery at the American Cancer Society, or had a man-to-man meeting, and he said, if I had to do over again, I'd go see this guy named Bob. Everybody hates him, and so I knew I'd like him.
That's a great description. Everyone hates him, so I'll like him. And for you, you know, were you taking into also account the longevity of your pursuits? You know, hope, you know, a lot of people who do follow the normal paths, it is really challenging to bike ride and to do these adventures because it's a significant change of lifestyle. Was that also a factor for you?
Well, early on, I decided I would do whatever I could to continue doing everything I was doing. And I was building something called Black Hawk at the time, and I stopped working completely. I dedicated myself 100% to this endeavor from starting, this would be January 8th, 1999, till about March 15th when I finally found Bob. But I did everything I could. If I read an article about somebody, I would call his office. If he didn't have an appointment for 5 weeks, I'd ask for the address. I'd order flowers on the way to the airport. I would fly in to see him. And then I would tell him that these other doctors told me this, this, and this. And 5 minutes later, I'm talking to that guy. You know, I was pretty conniving, as anybody who knows me in town realizes.
Rick, I'm wondering, as you helped Jim write this book, you, as we were talking about in the green room, you did an extensive amount of research to make sure that Jim was remembering things the way that they really happened. And what year was it that we did the Trans Rockies together, Jim? It was about 2005, maybe? 2004. This mountain 7-day mountain bike race in the Canadian Rockies from, as I recall, Fernie to Canmore. And we were talking about that, how you went back and researched to just, because the misremembering, like if Jim tells a story and I tell the story of that race, I'm sure it's all the facts are all mixed up and, you know, in memory.
Well, Jim was very adamant on the medical side that we'd be absolutely accurate, absolutely truthful, no exaggeration, no conjecture. And so that became the rule for all the travel. So to do that, we literally had to go back to Google Earth and retrace every step of the trip all the way through. And we'd argue in the Trans Rocky race. I went back and read people's journals of about 5 different races from different years, and I knew that backwards and forwards way better than his memory was. So we'd argue about where he went and what he did. I said, no, you didn't. And every journey was like that because I had Google Earth, and he had his memory. So it was a constant battle, and every time I tried to make it more exciting or more fun, he'd say, no, that never happened. we argued 3 days one time about the definition of waiting, because he waded into the Tasman Sea, or he dove in, or he walked in. So it was a constant search for truth, I guess.
Which is why people have co-authors, I suppose, because we are all our memory. It's not that we want to embellish or we want to tell the story differently. It's just how memory works and how it serves us or doesn't serve us. But your adventures are incredible around the world. So we've talked about Patagonia. We've talked a little bit about the Canadian Rockies. What's been your most memorable, and I would say, you know, the trip that you had the most perfect bad days on, so you would have stories later.
I bicycled from the south end of the South Island of New Zealand to the north end of the North Island of New Zealand. That's about 1,500 miles. And I did it in 2 different trips because I was building houses. I had to come back. But that, without question, was the most exciting part. And probably the highlight of the trip was this Manuka honey I discovered, where all the bees harvested, made their honey from whatever the marijuana flowers. And so somebody gave me a jar of that marijuana honey, and I would use it every morning for the rest of the trip. So I was very happy.
Was that pre-cancer?
That would have been pre-cancer, yeah.
Okay.
Not a treatment.
No, not a treatment.
I was going to say.
So, okay, we'll go. That was the most memorable. What was the one that, with Rick, you just really didn't want to remember, but you knew you kind of had to? That just maybe PTSD on that trip. You know, what was the one that really struggled for you?
Alaska.
Rick knows.
Alaska, for sure.
Why, Rick?
He went, from Anchorage all the way down through Alaska and through Denali, and he met a lot of people along the way, and we had different interpretations of how that went. One time Jim's usual costume then, when he'd have a bandana and a ponytail and some rotten T-shirt and the spandex shorts, and he pulls into this little town and he walks into a bar, and it gets very quiet, and he notices that there's a Bill Clinton photograph on the dartboard on the side, and there's their special today was the Hoot Owl. They were not Jim's kind of people, and he was about to order a latte and then thought, maybe I shouldn't just go for the latte here. And he did a lot of things like that. He went into a park out on a place called Wonder Lake that was a really great place to go, and he got there, and it had been booked, as Lynn, as you said, it's been booked for weeks, so he decides to camp on the side of the park. And the park people are watching him, make sure he doesn't try to sneak on their property. So he goes around behind a huge boulder, and he finds a picnic ground, and he takes the tables and makes a fort, and then puts his tent inside that, and they don't catch him, and he leaves the next morning, and as he gets on the bus to go back, the guy driving the bus says, look at that boulder over there, and out walks, in my mind, a 50-foot grizzly, where Jim had just been sleeping.
Hey, not everybody makes it, and I am a masochist.
Be willing to sleep in a ditch.
Next to a grizzly.
Next to a grizzly.
My goodness. Well, the experience of going through your own personal memoirs and photos is really something that everyone strives for. You know, some people yearly, they put together their photo collage of like what their year was. But to be able to take, and I'll ask, how long did this take? But to take, a year, 2 years, 6 years, whatever it was, for you and Rick, Jim, to go through your memories to tell these stories is really actually a unique opportunity. What was it like for you to really delve back into your memories and bring these back to life, Jim?
Well, you open a box and it's full of brochures and whatever. So each trip, if you went in my home, you would see, all over the world, different places I went. And I don't know, things, every time you see something, it just evokes another memory and it takes you back. So I guess I'll take all those to the nursing home someday, But it's so interesting. It's so much to relive. And this book is just amazing to me. I can't thank Rick enough.
Mm. Jim, 1 in 10 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer. 1 in 9 men. 60% of those men at age 65 or older. You, of course, were about 50. Almost 100% of men who have local or regional prostate cancer will survive more than 5 years after the diagnosis. You've learned so much about it. There's so many men out there, hopefully listening now, who are thinking, wow, I really need to hear this. I need to read this book. What other advice do you have for them?
Well, I really tried to distill down in the prostate cancer or PSA 101s the core facts. And if you're going to see a doctor who doesn't agree with any of those, I would go on and find another doctor. I certainly wouldn't call up Jim Doyle for medical advice.
Yeah.
So that's the key thing, I think, is reading. And then there's also a glossary in the back that WebMD allowed me to put in the book. So it tells every term, because there's so many terms that just put you to sleep. I mean, you can't read a paragraph about prostate cancer without scratching your head. And that's what most men face. Meanwhile, you're scared to death. And if you're 65 or older, the odds are very, very high you're just going to live with it and not die of it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's my advice.
I think the most important thing that Jim says in the book, and Jim says this, learn. Because there's so much conflicting information, there's so many myths, there's so many misconceptions that if you just want to know more about this, you have to learn. It takes a lot, and you're going to be your own guide. And that's the only way you really know what's right for you. And I think that's the final message of the book, is learn.
Mm. And again, it's a luxury to have the time to spend. As you said, you dedicated 100% of your time to doing that. A lot of people couldn't do that. A lot of folks would make a visit to their oncologist once they get the diagnosis and just go that route. And I don't know what the question is there, but if you don't have that luxury, you know, what do you do?
Well, that's why the end part, the 101s, is so important, because those are things nobody who's really engaged disagrees about. And if your doctor, you know, let's face it, med school is kind of trade school when you really get right down to it. And some people stop learning when they get out. And after that, everybody treats them like God, and pretty soon they start believing they're gods. But doctors are people. Anyway, so learn and read the 101s.
Great feedback. And as we leave here and hopefully get into ski season, the real reason you came to Park City was to, you know, ski. What words of wisdom do you give to all the new people who've exodused their previous East Coast, West Coast environments to come here and begin their same journey? Any words of wisdom?
Just one word, ski.
Pray for snow and ski.
Well, this evening's reception is at the Corner Store. That's at Park City Mountain from 4:30 to 6:30. There will be food and drink. Jim will be there. Rick will be there. And you'll have plenty of copies of the book.
Yes. And, you know, please tell all your friends, go on social media. You know, we 100% of any profit from the book will go into a foundation that will basically be cancer awareness, promoting awareness of some of these facts. Mm. And there are similar things emerging about breast cancer, by the way.
Mm. How's the journey been bringing this book to press and getting the word out about it?
Well, we decided not to go to publishers because they changed the book, and that was Jim's number one thing. So it became our own project. It took a little over a year, and it was intense because every chapter. We actually did all the medical chapters first because that was the one story we had to spend the most time getting right. And then the travel journeys were chapter by chapter, trip by trip, and they were a lot of fun. Then became, once we had the book, it's now we have to get it published. And then we had to learn that whole process of printing and formatting, and that's been a long journey. But the book is here, and by the way, Dolly's Bookstore has the book in stock.
And the Corner Store will be selling it all winter, too.
That's awesome.
Excellent. Well, Rick and Jim, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for coming back. Congratulations on finishing this book, and thank goodness for Rick, right?
Exactly.
Rick Barrow.
Thanks for having us.
Jim Doyle.
It's an honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now we welcome writer and author Jude Stewart, who has written about our most fascinating of the five senses. In her new book, Revelations in Air, A Guidebook to Smell, Jude takes us on a fascinating journey into the weird and wonderful world of smell, beginning with the lessons on the incredible biology and history of how our noses work. Stewart teaches us how to use our noses like experts. Once we are properly equipped and ready to sniff, Stewart explores a range of smells from lavender, cut grass, hot chocolate, to cannabis and old books. Using smell as a lens into art, history, science, and more. Jude Stewart, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you on air. We have so many questions. We're really excited. I can smell the energy here in studios.
Yes, feel it.
I've got to ask, what drew you to be so fascinated by smell? I mean, because we all honestly are, but it's to study it and to write about.
Yeah, great question. Well, I've written a lot about graphic design, and so I sort of consider myself a visual person, visuals first person, as many people do. And but at some point, you know, images weren't quite doing it for me, and I don't even know that I could have articulated that until I sort of stumbled into an art exhibit that was very focused on smell. And I just found it so visceral and exhilarating and kind of upsetting. And it was all the feelings, you know, at once. And I thought, this is incredibly powerful. And I'm not paying attention to this what should I learn about this? And so I fell down this rabbit hole and learned all these things and basically came up out of the rabbit hole with the book.
Wow. So I actually started as an art exhibit and then catapulted you into really just diving into this science of smell. Is it what's the terminology? Is it science of smell? What's the technical?
Well, it's called olfaction. The bodily process is called olfaction. It's crazy because, you know, if you think about the visual sense or the audio sense, the science of those has been largely kind of figured out. And we've known about, you know, the receptors in our eyes for years. There are four types of those. There are 400 types of olfactory receptors in our nose. And they were just discovered in 1990. There was a Nobel Prize awarded for that discovery in 2004. So it's really early days in terms of understanding how even the basic mechanism works. What's even weirder is that there are not just olfactory receptors in your nose, but they're actually in many parts of your body. So in your kidneys, your lungs, your skeletal muscles, there's parts of your body are smelling. Pretty much all of it is smelling at any given time. It's really wild.
I have heard, Jude, more people talking about the sense of smell in the last 18 months, go figure.
Uh-huh.
And of course, that is because it's one of the first things you notice about, many people notice when they get COVID is they lose their sense of smell, which of course is connected to the sense of taste. It's funny, just this morning I was talking to a friend who is recovering from COVID and she also has a baby. And another friend said, well, it must be nice. You can't smell the baby's, diaper. And she said, yeah, mm-hmm. That's actually a problem because even though she had never thought of it before, she relied on her sense of smell to know when it was time to change the baby's diaper. There are so many stories that you've heard during COVID, and I'm sure for you, it's just been fascinating to realize that there's this dawning, you know, sort of awakening to our sense of smell, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, millions of people around the world had no appreciation, as I did before I wrote the book, for why smell matters, and now they really do. I mean, the good news about that is that I was reading up on this, and like 95% of the people who do experience COVID and do smell loss, they get it back within 6 months. But 6 months is a long time to go without any of that texture that comes from our sense of smell, and it can be even longer than that. People go through these periods of parosmia, which is like distorted sense of smell, where everything might smell like the baby's poop, and that's not ideal either. I really feel for people who have had that smell loss because it's really highly linked to depression, anxiety. People aren't interested in sex anymore. They either lose weight or they gain weight because they're just they eat really salty processed foods, just anything for a hit of taste. So it's a real thing.
Yeah. We often laugh when dogs greet each other because, well, you know what, they sniff first, right,
sure,
on each
sure.
other. But we, and part of me says, I'm so glad that that's not my way of saying hi to someone else. But there is this way that humans say hi to each other. You talk about, you know, different cultures where they actually sniff each other in saying hello. I found that interesting.
Yes. Yes, I really enjoy learning about that. In the Arab world, there's a practice called the nose kiss, and it's kind of prevalent among men. You basically press the bridges of your noses against each other and then kind of inhale. New Guineans have a practice where they, you know, they're reaching out for the handshake, but you put your fingers into your friend's armpit. And then you can smell your fingers. If you think about like a French nose, French kiss, which is the cheek kiss, you know, a lot of that is bringing us very close and like inhaling your friend's scent. So what I'm finding is I'm really excited about hugging my friends again after COVID. And now I kind of take in a little whiff and I find it so gratifying to be close to my friends bodily again.
You know, that is so true. Many of us do love that new hug that we haven't had for a while. But I can't say I really have had too many people say, Pete, I've missed your smell. You know, can we appreciate everybody's smell?
Can you appreciate everybody's smell? Well, it's interesting. The body has it's many layers, the smell. So obviously we're all interested in not smelling like BO, and that's why we're wearing deodorant and we're taking showers and all that. So, yeah, nobody's loving that smell. But there are these other layers of what your body is revealing about itself through smell, your diet, your age, your possibly your occupation. There's also kind of a baseline smell that we all have that is unique and more so than our fingerprints. And it's giving off information about your health and about your the robustness of your immune system. So you are actually recognizable as an individual through your smell unless you have an identical clinical twin.
So there's almost like a unique fingerprint but smell print for each other.
That's
true.
And
can we trademark that?
Can we trademark that? Good question. I don't know. I mean, it might lead to kind of a creepy future, but I wouldn't worry. I think your friends miss your smell, whether they're saying that out loud or not.
But, Pete, I don't think your scent is trademarkable. I just got to be honest.
Not strong enough. But can you, let's say I wanted to trademark my smell or something that I, you know, designed that I smell. Had an aroma.
Yeah, you absolutely could. Well, there is probably the most well-known trademark smell is Play-Doh, which I kind of enjoyed. I looked into that because I thought, oh, this is like nostalgic, fun, childhood smell, and then discovered this surprising fact. Understanding that kind of involves understanding the difference between a patent and a trademark. So a patent has to do with a product's functionality. You know, does it do the thing that it's supposed to do. And a trademark has to do with non-functionality. It's, are we getting the real thing, the thing that we thought we were buying? Is this the real Play-Doh? So Play-Doh smells like itself and its ingredients, but it also has a little bit of extra, a fragrance added, and that mix together is trademarked so that you know you're really getting the true Play-Doh.
Well, there you go. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Jude Stewart. She's written a new book called Revelations in Air. We're talking about our sense of smell. A couple nights ago, Jude, I got home from work. My wonderful husband was cooking, vegetables and cooking dinner as he does. But there was some smell within the vegetables, and we have vegetables every night. But I said, wait a minute. That smell, it just takes me to my mom's kitchen. It's back when I didn't like vegetables, and it's the smell, and I don't know what it is, and I'm searching. You know, he's cut up a bunch of different vegetables. I'm like, what's in this thing? And I don't know what, I couldn't figure out what it was. Was this some element of the cooking of the vegetables that was not pleasant, but it took me back to the days when we're young and we don't like vegetables and our mom makes us eat them. There are so many smells that take us into our memory like nothing else.
Yeah. Oh, that's absolutely true. And it'll drive you crazy until you figure it out. I hope you should have him make the same thing again and see if you could figure it out. It'll be like scratching an itch. But yeah, there's a reason why, smell is so tangled up in memory. It's unusual among our senses in that, it doesn't smell kind of bypasses the new brain and these structures that are related to verbalization and these kind of higher order brain functions. And instead, it goes straight to our old brain. So, basically just to explain this super briefly, the smells go up your nose. They eventually reach a place which is right where eyeglasses rest on your face. And that's called the olfactory epithelium. And that's where your little olfactory receptors reside, and they connect with a part of your brain that's called the olfactory bulbs. And those are tangled up with the amygdala, which controls emotions, and hippocampus, which is related a lot to memory. So, if you're having an important memory happen to you right now, then generally you're feeling some emotions about that. And if there happens to be a smell right at that same time, those three things will fuse, and it's very hard to unfuse them.
Hmm. Wow, that's so interesting. Another story it was about 30 years ago that a friend stayed at a different time with another friend who lived in Holland. And we were talking about visiting this friend this summer, this most recent summer, and my friend said, oh, yeah, I just will never forget the smell of her apartment. It was some room freshener. And it immediately, I've thought about that smell in that apartment many times since then and thought, that is my association. And I've searched out that smell and I've never smelled it again. And I just thought, it's so funny that, you know, you can remember a smell and still talk about it, something that happened 30 years ago. Like, it really is cemented, as you say,
in
almost that like physical proximity of our olfactory to that part of our brain, right?
Yeah, well, I have to say, I'm going to congratulate you on air because you're very unusual in being able to remember a smell that you haven't smelled in a long time very clearly. That's something that a lot of us can't do, so good for you. It's funny, a friend of mine went on a you know, many of us like stayed in our house forever during lockdown, and then we started venturing out on little cabin trips and so forth. And my friend, you know, when she came back, she finally could smell her house again. You know, and she thought, oh, and it was such an incredible kind of latent smell, because of course we all love the smell of home, but also during lockdown, it's sort of such an intense feeling. It's the place you feel safe. It's the place you've not left, but it's also the place you stop smelling because you're there all the time. So she was very overwhelmed emotionally by that.
I fondly remember the smell of carbon copy and had a meeting with some younger staff, and they had no clue what I was talking about. And so I actually had to bring out the carbon copy to bring them into the same place, and still no affinity. They just thought it was a weird smell. So
you mean like the old mimeograph
yes,
thing?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I read about that dinner sheet smell in the book. And I'm 47, so I'm of that era where I could remember those dinner sheets. And and it doesn't really exist as a smell anymore. I'm impressed you were able to dredge it up.
Yeah, yeah. No, we have a stack of, you know, 5,000 copies that aren't being used. So I took some home just so I could remember things every once in a while. That feeling of the report card and the anxiety of bringing that home to my parents. So.
Totally, totally.
So, you know, all of these wonderful conversations about memories and nostalgia and how smell engages our emotions, but then you also go further with smell, and you say that we can become experts in your book. Talk to us about how we can become, what does that mean, and how can we become experts at smell?
I would say we can become more expert. I came into this, I want to be clear, like I came into this probably a B-minus smeller in terms of natural capability, and I'm probably like a B-plus now, you know. I think that meaningfully has, you know, improved my life. I mean, smelling in many ways is sort of like mindfulness turned inside out, you know. Instead of focusing inward on my breath or a mantra or something, you're focusing outward on the world, and it kind of pins you to a moment and a here and now, and that is hugely beneficial to my outlook on life. So I would say, yeah, in terms of becoming more expert, it's pretty simple. The book includes a lot of exercises that are kind of fun and sort of stupid human trick type exercises, but things to try, you know, to help get you more tuned into your sense of smell. But a lot of it is just like sort of paying attention, verbalizing, pushing yourself past that, oh, it smells like X, whatever the X is. And trying to describe things. And, you know, it's a very social activity. I was a little intimidated when I talked to a sommelier and here in Chicago, and, you know, about this, what you can learn about smell, about wine through smell. And he basically described that his whole training has been just more systematic versions of getting together with other sommeliers and verbalizing what they smell. So I felt vindicated in my little homegrown methods when I found out that that's how true experts have learned how to become really good at smelling.
That's so true. You know, you hear these sommeliers, I can't even say that word correctly, but you hear these wine experts and they can articulate and say that, you know, I can smell the peppers and the rose fragrance and, you know, all these essences. And I have no clue. I guess I haven't practiced enough. I'm a C or C minus smeller.
Well, check out that chapter and see. There are a couple things that they do that feel like a little bit like affectations, but they do in fact make the smells kind of open up. One of them that's a little dangerous to your carpet is that you take the wine glass and kind of hold it almost horizontal. And what you're doing there is you're creating like a lot of surface tension. That, you know, the liquid has a large amount of surface tension. So like a lot more smell comes out that way. And then you can kind of do these quick little sniffs that they do, or you can breathe a little bit through your mouth too. I mean, some of this smelling stuff is just being fine with being awkward, doing kind of weird things. And then you can have a, you have a taste. You can, you know, if you read, I thought it was a cheat to look at online and find out, oh, what are the notes I'm supposed to be smelling for? And in fact, sommeliers do that too. And you can have the actual thing online. If they, you know, if they say, oh, it smells like cherries, we'll have a couple cherries there and, you know, do a little compare and contrast, and you'll find the smells. And it's sort of a fun, again, a fun group exercise.
I knew someone in Tuscany, Italy, who was a farmer and had an olive orchard and manufactured olive oil. And at one point, he was invited to be on this very prestigious olive oil board of in this region in Tuscany. And he couldn't join it because he was a smoker, and that would have impaired his sense of smell. And this is what this prestigious board does. They rate the olive oils, which, it, you know, doesn't that just sound like a wonderful thing to be a part of? And he actually, from being a chain smoker, he quit smoking to do this. So obviously, then you get your sense of smell back. But what else impairs our smell, sense of smell?
What else impairs? I mean, yeah, that would be a big one. Let's see. I mean, more than anything, I think just not paying attention to it probably is the hugest impediment by far. You know, people just, if you pick up the wine, just gulp it down, or, you know, having the food and just eat it straight away. And what's nice about it is that it gives you that moment of pause. It sort of forces, you know, a sense of pause if you're going to try and smell something, and you can't do it for very long. Your nose will habituate pretty quickly, and you'll stop smelling it. So it's not, for those of us who are impatient, it's not going to slow you down too much, but it's sort of a worthwhile thing to do. But yeah, I think smoking is probably right up there in terms of things that are no-nos.
Just one more reason not to smoke. I'm wondering about the smell that we give off. You know, you talked about, you can tell like where your diet is and maybe your sense of health and that sort of thing. I think we could all say that when we have the kind of sweat or scent given off when we've just run 5 miles versus the kind of sweat or the smell we give off when we're really stressing, they're two completely different things, at least on my body. And I don't know about Pete, and I don't know about you, but it's probably
common.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad you touched on that, because one other thing we can smell in other people, believe it or not, is their emotions. So there's some studies, at least a couple emotions that we know of. So joy, disgust, and fear are three emotions that we can smell. And there's some fun studies that kind of get into that, and they involve a lot of people wearing T-shirts. One group of wearing T-shirts, experiencing some sort of stimulus, and then another group of people are smelling the T-shirts to see if they can figure out what the emotions are. And so one study, one group was wearing T-shirts, went in and watched Disney's The Jungle Book. So they're obviously very joyful, cheerful movie. And then this other group was watching the scariest parts of The Shining by Stanley Kubrick. So that's the fear group. So what's interesting is when those T-shirts are taken off and given to the other groups, people were asked to verbalize what they thought the smell was, but more also they were watching people's facial expressions and their eye movements, because we give off involuntary patterns there when, you know, you sense joy, when you sense disgust, like it's registering in your face pre-verbally before you say that. So they were actually very accurate in being able to determine which one was the joy T-shirts and which ones were the fear T-shirts.
And there's also this like 4D, or I guess now we could say almost 5D experience, where they're releasing smells into the theaters. What smell would we use for horror movies or that moment where it's really scary?
Oh my gosh, yeah, it's interesting. There's like a whole large history of smell-o-vision and the attempts to sort of do that really well and effectively. The art exhibit that I went to see does sometimes have like accompanying like theater programs or readings or movies, and it was called Smeller 2.0, and what was interesting about that particular one is that they had this specially outfitted room that could pump in smells but could also remove them really quickly. So it didn't have that weird kind of buildup that would happen over time. But it was almost just unreal, because you'd smell the Band-Aids, then you'd suddenly smell the, you know, orange, then you'd smell the sunscreen, whatever it was. And it was like almost just being like plugged into an electric socket.
Oh my gosh, yes. I could also even, the smell of, like, if you've ever gotten blood in your mouth, that taste, but I'm sure there's like a smell that could go with that, that could bring that taste into your mouth. That would be horrible, and it would be terrifying. Just, I think I bloodied my nose, or, you know, whatever that might be. Okay.
You're a devious thinker. I like this.
So I have one question. I always ask this when I'm out on a run and or a bike ride, or if I just need something to fill time. All right, you're out, you know, you're with your friend, and you, here's the question. You have to lose one of your senses, and it's vision, touch, taste, smell. Everyone will always go to smell first. I mean, without a doubt, people often are like, well, I can't live without sight, or I can't live without touch, or, you know, all these things. Smell is the first one. Why would you argue that smell should be kept and something else should be lost?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, okay, if we're talking about the context of a run, I would say maybe taste. I'd be going with taste. Because what is there to taste too much other than your own sweat, you know? I mean, you know, the other ones I can see, you got to be able to navigate, you got to be able to listen for traffic, you know. Yep. And I think that part of, I'm not a runner, but I am an active outdoor person, love to hike and so forth. And, you know, the smells of the surrounding landscape are what give the whole experience texture. So, like, why on earth would I do this? I might as well be at home on my treadmill if I can't smell, you know, the pine trees or the rotting leaves or whatever it is. So, yeah, that's my argument. You want to smell those leaves.
Well, and I think that, you know, as we've talked about, it's become, the sense of smell has become much more important more recently. Once you lose it, then you realize the importance of it. Jude Stewart, she has written a book called Revelations in Air. It's a guidebook to smell. And what a pleasure it's been speaking with you. And what a great book. Thank you, Jude.
Thank you so much, Lynn and Peter. This was really a lot of fun.
All right. Take care.